Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Welcome to the Lucky Let Court Podcast, a Tennis Now production sponsored by Tennis Express and a proud member of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. I'm Chris Otto, happy to be with you on the eve of the Australian Open. Main draw play kicks off tomorrow in less than 24 hours. We will be knee-deep in first-round action from Melbourne. We've got a lot to talk about. The draws were released on Thursday. Richard Pagliaro, Tennis Now editor, and Eric Goudreau, Tennis Now contributor, here to talk about the draws, which are quite difficult, I must say, for Rafael Nadal and Iga Świątek. We're also going to talk about, of course, the return of Novak Djokovic to Melbourne, where he will bid for his 10th title down under. And we're going to be talking about the Netflix special called Breakpoint, which was released yesterday. Watched all 5 episodes, and so has Eric Goudreau. So we've got a lot to talk about there with the highlights, the lowlights, and some of the interesting snippets from that really entertaining video that we saw. So why don't we get right to the conversation now, and I'll see you guys on the other side. All right. We are live, and Eric and Richard, I'm very pleased to be chatting with you on the Skype once again. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. Doing very well.
Cool.
I'm excited to speak to you guys, and we've got a lot of the draw to dissect, so I'm pumped up to talk.
The draw, for sure, which came out Thursday in Melbourne, and it's got a lot of interesting tidbits that we will certainly be discussing, but also the Netflix special. 5 episodes of the new Netflix series Breakpoint are out. Eric, you are so excited about this. You're kind of a film connoisseur, film buff. You've never made any secret about that. So I guess Breakpoint is right up your alley. I think you devoured the first 5 episodes rather quickly, and I'm sure you got some takes. So why don't you lead us off? Tell me some of your initial thoughts.
I definitely do. So ultimately, I feel like the producers of this series did a very good job of balancing the content to appeal to dedicated tennis fans and those that have never watched the sport before. Of course, in the first episode, there's an expected amount of background about how the tennis world works, how the tours work, how the scoring works, how the majors work and the draws.
Yep.
And that's get the uninitiated into that world. What I found most fascinating was the amount of access that the show had to the behind the scenes that most tennis fans never get on the practice courts, in the press room, in the players' hotels room, traveling to and from tournaments, with their families and their friends, their managers, their agents, and so forth. So for me, that was actually the most illuminating part of the entire series. I feel like that what probably was most interesting was the highlight that the professional tennis tour for many players can be, as all of us know, can be very isolating.
Yeah.
Can be a very lonely existence because the players are traveling from tournament to tournament with their core group of people. And it's at some points watching the entire series, if I was just a casual viewer, I'd be like, wow, why would anybody want to be a pro tennis player? Because this is a tough life.
Yeah.
So I think it'll be interesting to see how the series carries through to the next portion of the next season. I think it's coming up later this year with the players that they highlighted. Of course, the first couple episodes focused on Australia, the clay court season, and how those players achieved in the next part of the season. I think that's going to be very interesting to see. I also think that there, of course, there was a lot of chatter before this series even started about, oh, this is going to ignite a lot of interest in tennis because Netflix did the Formula One car racing series previously. But just to be fair, Formula One is a very different world to professional tennis. And I think to try to think, well, and that specific series has been on Netflix for a couple of seasons.
Yeah, four seasons now, it looks like.
So I think it's a more wait and see if this tennis series actually, once it gets going, can generate more interest, especially because it's focusing on current players outside of the legacy players that are no longer with us, like Serena, like Roger Federer.
Yeah, it's pretty wild, right? So I actually watched four episodes quickly, one last night and three today, and I'm halfway through the fifth, which is at Roland Garros already. So it kind of moves along with the thread of the season, which is cool. I wanted to ask Richard, because I know you didn't watch them yet, Richard, but I wanted to get your perspective as someone who like, now I can no longer speak with this perspective of what are you looking for? What do you think there is to gain for tennis? And what do you hope to get out of this Netflix documentary series when you do watch it?
I guess what always draws me in is the emotion that they endure throughout not only just the season, but just the course of a tournament week. Because with the win, it's just incredible when you're playing in front of 15, 20,000 people. The adrenaline, it really is like a narcotic. It's like a really, really huge high. And I always wonder after some of those epic night matches, like, how do you go back to the hotel and just go to sleep? Your body is like wired with electricity. So that always intrigued me, the behind the scene part. Like, how do you come down from a big loss and from a big win, and alternatively, you know, how do you recover from a devastating loss? And I think also just to push past the caricatures that we sometimes see, you know, everywhere, not just media, but fans, chat rooms, where like, oh, Kyrgios is this crazy guy that parties, or, you know, this player is the hothead that throws the racket. And just to see behind the practices and the tournaments, like what they're going through that maybe puts them into that mental state. I think Eric hit a good point. The loneliness and the isolation, like you go from being like people, 20,000 people grabbing at you, to being completely alone, like in a room by yourself. Like, how do you, I can't even imagine what the extreme that they go through. So that kind of thing intrigues me, but also just, you know, the day-to-day grind just to get through, you know, it's just hard enough just to be, get through your job and then think about doing that job like four or five different continents, different time zones, traveling where you don't have family or friends with you and you have to sort of figure it all out on the fly. It's fascinating. I'm really excited to see it. I have not. All I've seen is the trailer, so I'm really pumped.
It sounds like it's right up your alley, because I think you're going to get exactly what you're looking for. In fact, your first line of your answer was exactly what Paula Badosa said about how winning is a drug, the adrenaline of it. And the episodes that feature her certainly take you through the highs and lows of what it's like to try and perform at that level and what the pressures are that she faces. I thought the humanity of it was, I was a skeptic at first. I'm thinking, like, you know, tennis is kind of our jobs. It's 12 hours a day. It's sometimes longer than that. I feel like I know everything, been there, done that. What is this going to be for me? It's not going to have anything. But it turned out I was moved, and I was excited to be led into some of the intimacies that Netflix took us in on. Like, I visited the Berrettini family home. I visited Owens in Tunisia. And there were a lot of little, like, very behind-the-scenes kind of unique spots that I was surprised that they were able to offer to us. So in that sense, I was pleased. And it sounds like you were too, Eric.
Absolutely. And I thought that was the most, again, illuminating part of that series, that they were allowed to enter those players' homes, speak to their families, and learn more about their backgrounds, how they got interested in tennis. And that's something that even diehard tennis fans are not, that access, they're not granted. So for those tennis fans, that's absolutely amazing. And for people who have never experienced tennis or have no idea who these players are, that's the entryway to learning more about them and having an appreciation for them. sort of like when the Olympics come around every 4 years and they do the player profiles, the athlete profiles, and they go to their home countries and they talk to their families and everything. It's very similar. So I think that's a very beneficial thing to for fans of tennis and those that are just watching the series and learning about the sport for the first time.
Yeah. And what would you say about the fact, the symbology maybe of the fact that the very first episode is called The Maverick and it's all about Nick Kyrgios?
Well, I think that was, again, I think that's interesting because, and just thinking about the producers and thinking about the job they had to create this show, is they're presented with this, I will just say it, this character protagonist, Nick Kyrgios, that we all know has been part of tennis for so long, has been such an interesting and engaging person in the sport, but has not yet lived up to his full potential. So for last year's Australian Open, there was all this speculation about, is this his last Australian Open? Yeah, what's right. going to happen with him? And I'll be interested to see in the next section of this season when they move forward to Wimbledon. Because when you watch the Australian Open, think, well, this is it for Nick Kyrgios. This is it. He of course, won the doubles with Kokkinakis. But then the next half of the year, he actually did a lot. So I'd be curious to see how that forward momentum carries over.
Yeah.
The only critique I would say is they were very focused on just being very specific about you know, the calendar, and like they start in Australia and then they move to Indian Wells and then they move to Madrid and they move to Roland Garros. There was not a lot of moving back and forth between the whole year.
Yeah.
And I guess that was a decision they made to be very chronological about how they presented things.
Yeah.
But as we know, the start of the season doesn't necessarily mean that how you start the season is how you're going to end the season.
Yeah.
So that's just one critique of mine.
Yeah. This is not a critique, but I found myself not interested in the match footage at all. And I don't know if it's a critique on the way they presented the matches, or it was just the fact that I was really getting high off the personal, intimate portraiture stuff. And so like when I get to the matches, I'm like, well, I saw this match, I'm fine with it. It's not really presented in any different way than you would if you watched it on television. I mean, they threw in some wrinkles too, where I felt like Catherine Whitaker and maybe other people were doing voiceovers for the matches. In other words, they weren't actual commentary snippets. Rather, they were simplifying it to kind of move the story forward. When they couldn't find the right clip from a commentator, they would just use someone to do a voiceover about like Paula Badosa's journey to Madrid has taken her. So, and I felt like, I'm like, okay, skip forward almost. Like, you know, I don't know. What did you think of the match footage? I mean, some of it was neat, interestingly shot, and angles and stuff of the teams were unique. But to me, I think either they could have done a better job with it, or I'm just too deep into tennis that it didn't matter to me.
I agree that while the match footage was compelling the way it was shot and presented, that it was not overall the most compelling part of each episode.
Yeah.
And again, going back to the Formula One series, that are again completely different sports, that's Formula One, that's what drew people in. I watched some of those episodes because it's that you're in the driver's seat literally as they go down and they're on the racetrack and everything.
They're
very different, and tennis is very exciting, and those the highlights they showed were very exciting, but I think that the draw is going to be about why the players got into tennis, what drives them. Yes the shot making that is there, that's going to be exciting, but I think the ultimate draw and interest is going to be about what drives them day in, day out, month in, month out, year in, year out.
Yeah.
And I think as I said, going into like the access that we don't have, like into their hotel rooms, on the private jets, what have you, that's going to be the draw.
Mm-hmm. And Richard, sorry, you're probably sitting over there just listening and maybe bored, but since you didn't watch it, it's hard to loop you into some of this stuff. But I will tell you, Taylor Fritz, his victory at Indian Wells, and you guys, we know about how special of a title that was and how he really came from the brink of retiring before that match with an injury to deciding to play to then beating Rafa. But I don't know, there's something about the episode, it gives you the full impact. And I'm sitting there recognizing the fact that Taylor Fritz might be the only player in the world that could have won that match, that would have even dared to play that match, the way that Anna Cohen and Michael Russell and his team are advising him not to play. And the fact that he's just going, yeah, but I got to get out there. He's so adamant. I mean, this guy is just built different. I don't know. Your thoughts on that, Eric? Just like it gave me a new – I have a huge appreciation for Taylor Fritz already, but it gave me a new level of appreciation just watching that, watching him resist the temptation to retire, which was the advice everybody was giving him.
I will say that the episode focusing on Taylor Fritz, I actually – that was my favorite episode because – just having followed Taylor Fritz and everything. But I think of all the, I will say all the players profiled, I think I learned more about Taylor Fritz in that episode than all the matches and all the interviews that I've experienced. And I think they did a good job of focusing on him. Of course, as the producers of those shows, you have no idea that Taylor Fritz was going to win Indian Wells. But they carried it through, and they did a very good job of focusing on him and drawing out his personal experience there.
Yeah.
And I think for me, it was the most of all the players, that was the most illuminating, player profile that they focused on.
Yeah, it made me hungry for Owens's mom's cooking. Also, episode 4.
Yes. Absolutely.
I'm like, what is she making? That looks so good. Rice and chickpeas, some kind of awesome Tunisian style feast. But yeah, I mean, I enjoyed a lot of it. And I think the darkness of the sport, it's hard. They're, like we always talk over the years about Nadal and the suffering and what tennis players go through. And you see it with every single player. I mean, these players are on the edge in terms of mental health, in terms of just keeping their sanity. And there's so many demons. And I think there's like this show to me was about the darkness and the light of that tennis players endure. And I think Richard was talking about in the beginning that he wanted to see some of that. You're going to see tons of it, Richard. I think you're going to have a good time. But we should probably move it forward. Oh, last thing, actually, the choice, first of all, tip of the hat to Courtney Nguyen, who did a great job, like playing a starring role as kind of a narrator in the series and really kind of like helping bridge the gap between the uninitiated and the initiated. And also Andy Roddick did a great job. Sharapova plays a big role in this, which was surprised me. And I think there were some good moments, and it took her a little while to warm up, but then she said some pivotal and key things, which were interesting and gave some good insight. So it was good to see her. It was an interesting choice. I was definitely surprised because I actually did not know your final thoughts on that and the use of those characters, Eric.
I absolutely thought that utilizing Maria Sharapova, Andy Roddick, Chris Evert, Chris Evert gives one of the best lines in the show. I'm not going to give it away, but for me, it was like, that's Chris Evert.
Yeah.
I thought the analysts and experts that they picked to deliver that commentary was spot on. So I appreciated all their viewpoints.
Yeah. In the end, it's bingeable, I think. Probably it's tennis fans that are listening to our podcast today. And if you're on the fence about whether you should watch it or not, I mean, it's pretty much a no-brainer. You're going to enjoy it. You might know a few of the things that you're seeing already if you're a diehard. I mean, there's some crazy diehard fans out there that know a lot about these players, but I still think you're going to enjoy it. And I think it's great that it's come to Netflix and that there's 5 more episodes. I'm looking forward to see how the season finishes. I mean, with Carlos winning the U.S. Open, there are a lot of crazy stuff that happened, right?
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Novak Absolutely. Will get into the mix a little bit too, which will be interesting.
Absolutely. And one thing I will add, One does not need to watch all the episodes in sequence. So you can read the episode descriptions. Obviously, tennis fans have their favorites.
Yeah.
All I will say is that if you feel like you don't want to watch a specific episode, you don't have to. You can kind of pick and choose. And I think that's an interesting choice as well. I think because there's not a through line between episode one and episode five.
Yeah.
So I think that's an interesting choice that the producers made to highlight specific players throughout the specific episodes. But again, one does not have to start at episode one to get through the end of this season. Mm-hmm.
True. And good stuff. And another favorite thing of mine was Matteo Berrettini kicking out Ila Tomjanovic from the room that morning, where she's like, babe, I got to do an interview with Tennis Channel at 8 a.m. That was after he'd beaten Carlos Alcaraz in the third round, and he clearly needed some sleep. And he's like, no, you're not. He's like, go do it somewhere else. And then they cut to Courtney saying, you know, tennis players are rather selfish and they need to be. It was just a cool moment. She understood completely. It was
one quick thing. And one other thing I wish they would have done in the first episode was just give a little bit more history about tennis and, the champions. I understand that this specific series is focusing on the current generation, but I think to give new viewers just a little bit more about, like, why these majors are so important, who has come before them. I think they could have just done a little bit in the first episode, just to, like, lay the groundwork.
Yeah, I know. If they're going to tell you how to keep score, they might as well tell you a little bit about the slams and why they matter so much, how there are these touch points of the season. Good point there. Yeah, I mean, there are definitely – we could do a whole other episode and make our recommendations to the producers of the show for next time. But let's talk a little bit about the tennis that's in front of us. Sans Netflix coming up. The Australian Open is about less than 24 hours away from starting. We've got draws, and I think we've got a lot to talk about. Richard's probably chomping at the bit, ready to highlight some of the key things he's noticed in the men's and women's singles draw. Richard, throw a dartboard and start wherever you want. Get us started here in the conversation.
I guess I just start at the top, because Rafa's a top seed and the defending champion, and he's going to hit it right out of the gate, first round against Draper, and a lefty, you know, a tough lefty, a talented lefty, and his only opening round loss in the history of the Australian Open was to a lefty, Fernando Verdasco.
Oh, good info.
Obviously a different player than Draper, different style, but still, it'll be a challenge right out of the box. And I just think his whole section is really worth noting, because you've got the potential for a rematch with TFO, and remember that, how exciting that was. And then, obviously, a possible rematch with Medvedev of the Australian Open final in the quarterfinals, which is pretty incredible when you think about where some of the Grand Slam champions dropped in this draw. So I think that's an intriguing one right out of the top, and it's going to be tough in my view for him to get back to the final.
Yeah, elaborate a little bit, Richard. I mean, Rafa's 0-2 on the season, 2-3 set losses at United Cup, 1-2 Dimonor, 1-2 Nori. He's lost 6 out of his last 7. We don't know if his serve is at 100% based on the ab injury he had last year. There's a lot of stuff that's, you know, not pointing in the direction of a successful title defense, and yet it's Rafa, right?
Exactly. And even last year, where people questioned, could he, you know, he had not won the Australian Open in so long, could he do it? And then even when he was down in the final to come back from that 2-set deficit, it's Rafa. Anything is possible with Rafa, and he's going to be determined to try to defend, but he's never defended a hard court slam. And let's be honest, it's a brutal draw. It's a really tough draw. It's a tougher draw than Novak has. And he's got the pressure of also Novak coming back and coming for the record. You know, to tie the Grand Slam record, but also push past him in the career title chase. So there's a lot on the line. There's a lot of pressure. And as you said, you know, we don't know physically how he is, although he says he's feeling better on the practice court. It's going to be interesting. I'd say the one interesting thing, I looked ahead a little bit at the weather, and it looks like, with the exception of Tuesday, it's going to be uncommonly cool, at least the forecast I saw.
That could help him, yeah. Eric, what are you thinking Rafa-wise? What are the tea leaves that you're reading say?
Well, I agree with Richard, that, I mean, again, one would never discount Rafael Nadal, but it's going to be interesting, especially since his comments, I guess, yesterday, keep track with Australia about the actual tennis balls they're playing with.
He doesn't like those balls. Surprise.
He doesn't like them. But then again, Nadal rarely likes the tennis balls that he's ever playing with. So that's here or there. But anyhow, let's look ahead. I'm actually looking ahead to the second round. Let's say he gets past Draper. And then he has this potential matchup either between two Americans, Nakashima and McDonald. Now, I'm not saying that Nadal would not defeat either of them, but that's an intriguing – that first round's intriguing to me alone. Yeah. And then both of them have potential, right? So it's yeah, I agree. It's a tricky, tricky draw. And then, of course, you've got TFO sitting there potentially in the fourth round. So mm-hmm. It's interesting to me. And then we start looking later and, potentially Medvedev in the quarters. Potentially Korda, maybe Shapovalov is in his draw.
Never know.
This is tricky.
Yeah, no, he could be, even if he does somehow make it through the quarter to the semis, it could be a case of him playing a lot of sets and having to work really hard. And if that happened, and if he fell short at some point, I think Rafa fans and tennis fans in general probably wouldn't need to be too disheartened about it. You could just look at it as a step in the right direction, just winning some matches, gaining some confidence, and then, you know, what comes next? Healthy at Indian Wells, Miami, and then sets up for the clay for making more history. So, I mean, even if he doesn't win this tournament, which for the first time in my life, I've probably, like, pretty convinced that he's not going to win a tournament. Like, that, it's hard for me to picture it. But then again, that's usually when he likes to prove you wrong and makes you eat your words, right? So, but yeah, good point. And that Nakashima-McDonald match could be great. And if I'm not mistaken, Richard will know this for sure. And you probably do too, Eric. Didn't Mackie and Rafa, didn't they play five sets once in Australia?
I'm something. Not 100% sure, but I can look it up. But
yeah.
I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, no worries. We'll circle back to that. But I'm pretty sure they had some kind of moment at the Aussie Open. But anyway, stay with the men's draw. How did Novak do, Richard?
Yeah, I think he should be happy with the section he's in. I would. It's interesting that he played the EXO with Kyrgios on the Friday night before, first ball, and they're in the set where they could, that would be a great matchup if that came off, if Novak played Nick in a Wimbledon final rematch. But Rublev is also there, and Rublev's a dangerous character. The thing is, Rublev is he wins with pace, and Novak deals with pace really, really, really efficiently, really well. I think, we touched on it the last time we spoke, is the hamstring. Okay, but he looked like he was moving pretty well in that EXO. I think the intriguing guy in Novak's section is Holger Rune, because he beat him in Paris. He's very confident. He's a dangerous player. We've seen him do it at other slams, and we saw at the U.S. Open the first time they played what kind of match it was. And also just sort of from a karmic sort of situation, whenever he comes up against Pablo Carreño Busta, it's always a freaky, it's a weird, just weird thing. It's like a full moon on court, like something strange happens, and they could play again. And of course that was the opponent, when he got booted from the U.S. Open. But I think overall he's got to be really happy, and to me it's an easier path than Rafa for sure.
Yeah.
But it's still, how will the leg hold up? How will he adapt to the pressure? I think the good news for him was playing that EXO, where he got a really rousing response, but also Adelaide, where a lot of the Serbian fans came out and they're really appreciative, and he said and did all the right things in terms of paving the way for the public for his comeback. I'm sure there'll be some people upset, but I think by and large he sort of smoothed that out. So
yeah,
it looks good, but also all the pressure is on him because history's on the line. But I think he'd much rather be where he is than where Rafa is, put it that way.
Yeah. Two things. It was Smicek I was thinking about. 2015 took Rafa to five sets.
Right. Where he conceded the serve, where he said getting the first serve over.
Yeah,
that
right.
was the big moment.
I don't know why I got that. I mean, it's totally not Mackie. And Mackie won four games against Rafa when they met in their only meeting at Roland Garros, which that's par for the course there, I guess. So anyway, Eric, Novak's the heavy favorite in your eyes. What do you think? What are you thinking about Novak and his return to the Australian Open, where he is the dominant premier player, nine-time champion, going for number 10?
I absolutely think that Novak is the favorite again, because, as I said on a previous podcast, because of the 2022 season, he played sparingly because of his vaccination status. And I think because of that, he is refreshed.
Yep.
He is primed, as we've seen in the lead-up events in Australia. The fans are there for him. There is, from what I can gauge, no animosity.
Yep.
So that's in his corner as well. As we know, Novak loves having the fans behind him, although he is the best at playing when the fans are not with him. But the fans are going to be with him, and that's going to be a plus one. So good luck.
Yeah.
I think the player we actually spend a little bit of time talking about is number 19 seed Nick Kyrgios, because once again, he is the wild card at this event. And again, as in the Netflix series that we talked about, we don't know what's going to happen. But if anybody is going to disrupt Novak Djokovic, it could well be Nick Kyrgios.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, Richard, talk about Holger Rune. That's a potential third rounder for Nick Kyrgios. That will be a first week matchup to die for.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that will be. And Kyrgios was asked about that in media. He made some interesting comments. He really respects Holger Rune. But I don't know. Kyrgios, it's just he is so – he's like lightning. You just don't know when he's going to strike. You don't know. And also, you know, the doubles factor, that they're defending in doubles, so he's playing more. And he didn't really play any tune-up, any lead-up to this because of the injury. He pulled out of United Cup, so you don't really know what you're going to get. But he looked good in that exhibition, and the crowd will be insane for Kyrgios if he gets on a roll. And if that match comes off, I mean, that would be absolute must-see TV global. I mean, that would be an insane match. I would love to see that come off. And that's the kind of match that Nick Kyrgios lives for. So,
yeah.
I mean, you would hope it would come to that, but, you know, Kyrgios has got a lot of work to get to that point. I mean, and we don't know what kind of condition he's, you know, what is he capable of, best of five against some of these really talented players, just to get to Novak. So, yeah, I agree. Novak's definitely the heavy favorite, but, you know, Kyrgios is the match I'd love to see come off. But, you know, there's some other guys in there. I think in the top half, like a guy like Tsitsipas is really hungry. I think Felix ended the year on a tear. He's one of the few guys who's beaten Novak, even though it was best of three. I know he's in the top half. It's a different section. But I think that's also an interesting section to see if some of those young guys can break through. And then on the bottom, you have Casper Ruud, who was, you know, had a shot to be world number one and finished the year strong. He could make a push again to another semi. I just think it's a bad matchup for him against Novak. I just think Novak has it. It's just a tough match. I don't think he can really hurt Novak over five sets, if Novak is Novak, as we know him. But Ruud is dangerous, and Fritz, as you guys alluded to during the Netflix segment, he's also really tough in that bottom quarter.
I just want to speak a little bit about Ruud, because if he gets through his first round, he could potentially face Jenson Brooksby in the second round, which, as Brooksby has proven, is a tough player to deal with. And then he might potentially face another American, Tommy Paul, in the third round, who's been on the upswing in the last few months. So I'm just wondering if there's a potential for either Paul or Brooksby to potentially knock out Ruud before the fourth round.
I think there's potential there for sure. I think you're right, Eric, to highlight the Americans and say that they're dangerous. I think they are all over the draw, and there's just a big push going on right now with the American men. The women, they're always on point, right? But there's a lot of confidence growing from what Fritz did last year, from what Francis did, and I think they're all starting to believe in themselves more in these events at this level. And so in that sense, I don't see why not. It'll be up to Casper to play his very best tennis to get through these guys for sure.
And I just want to also just go back to Daniel Medvedev, because he is the seventh seed, which, again, for him is a lower seed. But maybe this is the opportunity for him to just sort of, you know, be the dark horse a little bit and kind of coast through, because everybody's focusing on Nadal. Everybody's focusing on Djokovic. People are focusing on Tsitsipas. People are focusing on Kyrgios. And, you know, let's not count out Medvedev here. He actually could potentially be the disruptor, like as he likes to be, and take the whole thing.
Richard, thoughts on Daniel?
It's interesting you say that, because if you told me right now, pick the finalists, I would say Djokovic versus Medvedev and go from there. But, you know, it's a lot. But I agree with you totally. And he's got a lot to prove, and he's got a little bit of a chip on his shoulder just because of how everything that went down last year. And also, you know, just the uncertainty over this year as well. So you just want to – and also that he's just not as good as those other contenders we talked about on clay. So, you know, you want to rack up the points now while you can, because hard court's his best service. So I think the urgency is there for him. And, look, he knows in his mind, in his heart, he should have lifted the title last year. It was there. It was there for him. Everything was there for him. And even after he blew the lead, it was still there at the end. He could have won it. So I think that will light a fire under him rather than debilitate him.
What can we say about Medvedev's form in general? The start to the season was promising. He won a few close matches, but then wasn't able to really push Djokovic, lost in straight sets. And we know if we go back a little further, he really wasn't playing his best at the end of last season. So, like, does something need to change for Daniil, or does he just need to kind of find whatever it is, maybe that little percentage of his game that's been missing? What's going on with him? Like, is he ready to do what we think he might do, which is reach the final and potentially win this title?
I think he's always ready to reach the final. I think actually it's probably better for him to not be in the conversation about
that is your point then. Okay.
Yeah, because I think he's fine with just like, I'm going to play my match. I'm going to win my match. If the crowd loves me, so be it. If they don't love me, so be it. I'm just going to play, and win, and win. And that's what got him to the level he is now. And I think actually where he is right now, that's going to play in his favor.
Okay, good point. You know, I'm just a little unsure about him overall, because he lost every match at the ATP Finals last year. I mean, granted, the competition's tough. Djokovic, Rublev, Tsitsipas lost first round in Paris. So I'm kind of like thinking, where is the Daniil that we know and love? Yeah, he won the Vienna title. He was strong throughout the season, but he wasn't that magical Medvedev ever since Australia last year.
Absolutely. What I would say is that there's more pressure on Tsitsipas to do something in Australia than Medvedev. Let's put it that way.
Good point. Very good point. That'll be something to watch, because the pressure, as we know, can make or break a player in these events. How about we switch to the women? There's a lot going on there. And I think if we talk about Rafa having a difficult draw, and we agree with that, we can also say that Iga Świątek she can certainly handle it. She's the world number one by a long shot, and already a three-time Grand Slam champion at the age of 21. She'll be the favorite in Australian Open, no matter what the draw sheet says. But it is a tricky draw. Richard, take us through what Iga's facing here in Melbourne.
It's interesting that, you know, Rafa's her favorite player, and it's a Rafa-like challenge for her, because if you look at right out of the box, Niemeyer, even though, you know, you're thinking, okay, she should just roll her. Look, she took her to three sets at the U.S. Open, so she's going to go in with confidence. I mean, obviously, she's world number one. She should win that match. But then you jump right to the third round, where you have potentially either former U.S. Open champion, you know, Bianca Andreescu, or Marie Buskova, who got to the Wimbledon, who beat Garcia at Wimbledon last year, and, you know, is a talented player and also a good doubles player. And then if you get through that, you've got either Collins, the Australian Open finalist from a year ago, or you've got Rybakina, who's the Wimbledon champion, and nobody ever talks about her, but she's got one of the best serves in the sport. And I mean, that's just a really tough just to get to the quarterfinals. So
another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Yeah, I mean, obviously she's a favorite, and after everything she did, you still got to like her. Also, her athleticism on that surface, I think, will really serve her well. I just think that round of six, if she got by the third round, I think that round of 16, I mean, Collins beat her down, I mean, on that same. So I think that's a problematic hurdle for her. If she were able to get through the round of 16, sure, I could see her going all the way. But I think that's a really tough match, not only style-wise, but emotionally. You've got two players who can disarm you, and you're the best player in the world. That's a scary match.
Eric, take it away.
I will say that, unfortunately, but fortunately for her, she benefited from Paula Badosa withdrawing, because she was originally in her section of the draw. So that's a plus for her. So maybe I agree with Richard. I think she's got a tough section to draw, but that helps. So, I'm going to go with Iga. I'm going to go with Iga to go all the way to the finals, at least, because I just think she has proven over the last year how to navigate through all these situations, especially on hard courts.
Yeah.
And I just she's the player to beat. That's why, because she's number one. She's the player to beat. And I think that I'll be interested to see how Rybakina, if that happens or if it does, but I still think she's a player to beat. I'm very interested to see how Jessica Pegula plays at this Australian Open, because I think she may be the winner. I think she's kind of been in this form for the last 6 months, and I think maybe this is her time, especially on hard courts. I don't know. That's my pick.
She's been all business so far this year.
That's right. She's my pick to win it. But we'll see. I think Iga is the player to beat. But I'm going with Jessica to win it.
Interesting stuff. And now let's keep in mind that Coco Gauff is Iga's potential quarterfinal opponent. Pegula is also in this section. She'd meet up with Iga in the semis. Finally, over the hump against Iga at United Cup with a really eye-opening 6-2, 6-2 victory. What is that going to do for Pegula's confidence, do you think, Richard?
I think her confidence is going to be sky high, and also, you know, just coming off the career year she had last year, qualifying for the WTA Finals in singles and doubles, and also putting the complete game out there where she's sort of applied the doubles, the transition, the ability to finish at net, you know, push the point, put the pressure on the opponent on the break point. She's shown a more complete all-around game. And I thought the big key when she really smoked Iga at United Cup, granted, it, you know, it's United Cup, it's not the Australian Open, was that she took the backhand down the line early and she hit it really, really accurately. And I think you've got to be able to go down the line against Iga, especially on that wing. And she did that really well. So I agree with you both. She's going to be really dangerous. I just think in that section, if I had to pick someone, I mean, I would just pick someone who's maybe got a little bit bigger weapons. But I do think if Iga gets through the fourth round, I think she's just owned Coco. I mean, she's just dominated that matchup. I loved what I saw from Coco in Auckland, and I was going to pick her as my sort of dark horse to get to the final. But if she gets Iga, I cannot pick her in that match. I mean, Iga has blown her out in a lot of those matches. Coco's
going
to have to play exactly like she did in Auckland, really push the point, really use the volley, and be super uber aggressive if that match came off. Yeah. But that's totally in Iga's favor. Coco's got to show her something differently. I mean, it's totally in Iga's favor if that match came off. Pegula would be the one to stop her if anyone is going to stop her before the final. Mm-hmm. But like I said, watch that fourth round if that comes off.
No, we certainly will watch that. By the way, hot players on the women's side heading in. Sabalenka comes in with a title. Belinda Bencic locked up a title last night. Coco Gauff, as you mentioned, she won a title in Auckland, so a lot of players in good form. Kvitova has been good so far. Veronika Kudermetova has been playing well. Garcia has been good. Pakula has been good. I mean, yes, I think it's kind of like you guys are setting the table here for it's kind of Iga against the field, and I agree with that. And I always back Iga right now to win the title, but there's a lot of good players. Go for it, Eric.
I just want a quick question about Ange Bourg.
Yes.
So, such a popular player. She's going to have whatever player she's playing against, she's going to have the crowd with her. Is the Australian Open the time that she finally breaks through, or what? I don't know. It's going to be interesting because I feel like if anybody's going to break through, it could be her, but I don't know.
I think she set the table for it, right? By persevering last year and reaching the two slam finals. Yes, losing both, but I think a lot of growth happened across the course of those two big finals. And I think she's ready to do it. I think it's time for her. You know, it really is. It makes sense for her to take the next step as soon as possible. And so here's an opportunity. She's in the draw on the opposite half of Iga. A lot of good players, as we mentioned. I don't know. Richard, you care to weigh in on it?
I'm really rooting for her to win a final, and she's to win a major, and she's been in the last two major finals. So, like you said, it seems that the table is set. I just worry about she's got some big hitters in her set. She's got potentially Samsonova. She's got potentially Sabalenka. I mean, she's got players who can really, really hit big and go after her. So. The good thing for her is she's able to sort of abbreviate the backswings, and she's able to, you know, take the pace off the ball, use the slice, use the drop shot and stuff like that. But those are players. And like you said, Sabalenka's been on fire, not only winning Adelaide, but what she did at the WTA finals, that final run. She seems to be sort of over some of those service issues she has. And if you put her, let's say we get some rainy days and the roof is over the court closed, I mean, you know, when she gets a serve going, it's a dangerous serve. So I would keep an eye on her. But I really hope Ons can do it. And I think you made a good call on Belinda Bencic. You know, she's a dangerous player. Maybe she's not quite as quick or as athletic as some of the players in that section, but she really anticipates well, and she can put it together on a hard court, as we saw when she won the Olympic gold. And, you know, she's been a U.S. Open deep in the U.S. Open semi, so she's someone to watch.
I will also add that in Anza's total section of the draw, she has two very dangerous floaters in Garbiñe Muguruza. Camila Giorgi, Sloane Stephens. So there's these Shelby Rogers. So there are these players, unseated, total floaters, extremely dangerous, that she's going to have potentially deal with. So that's the other wrinkle there.
There's always
And it's a different pressure when you're the second seed, where you're a name, where people want to take you down because you were the Wimbledon finalist, the U.S. Open finalist. So I hope she can definitely. I hope she does it. I just think and she traditionally, historically, hasn't played great there. The flip side is she didn't play last year because of the back injury. So she can really only go in sort of more freely, knowing, look, I can only really go up. I can only pick up points here because I wasn't here last year. So. Right. I think that helps her psychologically, but, you know, she doesn't have a great history. I think the quarters is her best result. She hasn't done traditionally well there.
Quarterfinal in 2020.
It should play to her strengths. I mean, it should play to what she does well.
Yeah, I mean, all courts play to her strengths. I mean, that's the thing about her.
Right.
One player I want to just briefly touch on your thoughts is Caroline Garcia.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
She came in like a house on fire at the end of the season. And she's right there at number four at the seed. So I'm just curious your thoughts.
I'm so 100% behind watching her follow through on what she did last season, which is remarkable. The way she plays the game, the amount of aggression she's playing with, the freedom in her game, it's beautiful to watch. It's been a great success story. Her stated goal, she said yesterday in press, she wants to start thinking about winning a major now. Not exactly sure when, but that's what she's setting her sights on, and I think she has the game to do it. It's just a matter of, again, you know, winning against those internal demons and believing and following through on it. I don't see why she can't do it. It's hard to expect her to have this level of success for another season, but the game is there. So, I mean, that's a player we certainly should be mentioning. Fourth seed, faces Catherine Sebov, a Canadian qualifier in the first round. I don't see really – second round matchup, going to be tricky. Going to be all eyes on either Alize Cornet or Leila Fernandez in the second round. So we'll know what kind of form and how she's dealing with the pressure pretty early in week one. But, yeah, I mean, Richard would – I mean, and Eric, I feel like she can win a slam this year. It's just a matter of taking that next step.
Absolutely. Again, I think it's, again, like you said, about the belief and just building on what she did last season.
Yeah. I think is Richard. Maybe Richard disappeared. Maybe he warned us.
I agree with you guys. I mean, especially if she serves the way she did the second half of the season. For me, the challenge for her is, like, she's all in on this total aggression. Like, I'm going to stand 3 feet inside the baseline to take your serve on the right. I mean, some of these ladies are bringing 150-mile-an-hour heat. You got to be smart enough and just humble enough to back up sometimes and read the play, read the opponent. Yeah. I mean, I think she's just so committed to that. Like, she won't back off. And she's been really successful playing that style, but I'd like to see her be a little more adaptable situationally. But certainly she has the talent, and we've seen her win slams and doubles. I mean, she's definitely right there. I agree with you both. The one player I would say, if you're looking for someone that's sort of outside the box, is Madison Keys. I know she can be erratic. I know she can be up and down. She's had good results there. She's a big hitter. You know, you get her, get the serve going. She's, you know, a former U.S. Open finalist. She's very unpredictable. She's volatile. She can hit herself off the court, you know, commit 60 errors. But if she's on, she can hit anybody else off the court, too.
Always a threat to go deep, and pretty much that's always true. Does it slams.
Just really quick, what do you think about Sabalenka? Because Sabalenka said she's now zen. She is focused. She has adapted a whole new mental focus. And of anyone that should have probably won a major by now, it's Sabalenka. Is she going to do it here? I don't know, but she's always the question mark here.
And I think you raise a good point also, because I think 6 of the last 12 women's slam champions were maiden champions who had never won a slam. So going into this, I would say if it was going to be someone who's never won before, I would definitely look at Sabalenka or Hans as the two, you know, who were trying to break through. I mean, a lot, you mentioned Garcia, obviously, you got to think of her, but those would be the two I would be looking at, and they're in opposite Iga, so they can hope somebody picks Iga off.
I'll say this. I don't know if she's going to do it here, but at still not 25 years of age with the level of talent that Sabalenka has, and like you alluded to, Eric, the growth that she makes. Yeah, she hits a lot of speed bumps and you know, has to fight with herself and has to get over some of her issues, definitely both mental issues with, you know, with success and in various elements of her game. But I think she has nothing but time to win a slam, and I think it'll for sure happen in the next couple of years, maybe more than one. And if I may circle back to Carolyn Garcia, I loved your point, Richard. I think that's very important, and actually inspired me to maybe think more about this and write more about this. Maybe the thing that's going to keep or get Carolyn Garcia over the hump is learning to have a little bit of humility with that plan B and to open up a little bit tactically to being able to change over the course of a match, depending on the matchup. And maybe that's the thing that she was missing last year, and that she ran into a wall in the U.S. Open semis. And maybe that's the thing that she'll need to do. It takes a lot of sacrifice to win these majors, right? Maybe that is the thing that she'll need to do. And if she can do that, you know, evolve in such a way that it allows for herself to be a more diverse player, then she gets over the hump. And maybe if she can't do that, she doesn't get over the hump. So I think I just wanted to circle back and say that was a good point and something to watch out for.
Well, stubbornness could be her best friend or her worst enemy.
To a point.
I mean, sticking to that, I mean, no doubt that definitely that tactical shift definitely absolutely helped her. The thing that really blows my mind about her is if you've ever watched her in Fed Cup or with team play playing doubles, she can play all course. She's a beautiful volley. She knows how to close, but it just she wants to play grip and rip so bad. It's almost like she just wants to end the point one way or the other.
It's
so
fun.
That makes me a little bit nervous. Like, maybe she just wants to get it over with one. Whereas I think if you look at someone like Rafa, one of the greatest players who ever lived, he's humble enough to say, look, this guy's serving 130. I got to move back. I got to give myself a chance to get the ball in the court and rally. I realize she's not looking to play long rallies, but she can if she had to. She's a good enough athlete. I just don't feel she taps into the whole depth of her game. Mm-hmm. She can play from anywhere. She can do a lot of things with the ball, but she's so dialed in on, like, I'm just going to rip the hell out of this ball if you give me any. And it's like, sometimes they're serving big. You got to respect that, you know?
Yeah.
Or sometimes they have a great slice where they're going to tell you wide. You got to respect that, too. You just have to understand, you know, you can be core committed to that, but you got to be able to sort of roll with the tide and what's happening out there. Yeah. And she's a veteran. She understands that. I'd just like to see her employ it. That's mm-hmm. all.
Yep. That's a good point. So parting shots for you guys. Eric, I'll let you go first. Anything that has been left up unsaid until now?
All I will say, I think that, again, I'll be very interested to see the crowd reaction for Novak Djokovic. I think it's going to be very warm and receptive. And, again, I think he's a player to beat on the med side. And I'll be interested to see, again, how Iga on the women's side kind of handles the pressure of being the favorite for number one.
Yeah, that'll be fun. And Richard?
I would say, looking ahead to the year overall, I think we're going to see a Russian or a Belarusian after the controversies they went through last year. I think a Russian will win a Grand Slam title this year, and I think we'll see an American Grand Slam champion. Maybe not at this tournament, obviously, looking at Djokovic, but this year I think we'll see someone like Coco Gauff or someone like – I think we'll see an American – yeah, because the tour, if you look at the men's side especially, I think the big three have won like 17 of the last 19 Australian Opens. Only Stan and only Safin are the only guys break that stranglehold. Sooner or later, you know, the European dominance – maybe it subsides, maybe it doesn't, because you got people like Tsitsipas. I think the Russians are going to will be heard from this year. I think they'll make a statement. And I think, as you guys alluded to on Sabalenka, I don't just want to, you know, just repeat that point. But I think she can do it this year. And I'd like to see her and Ant. Those are two I'd love to see break through, because they want it so bad. And look, Sabalenka, and her losses in the semi, Grand Slam semi, she's played well. It's not like she's gagged
she's
or choked.
So
I mean, she's competed hard. So she's putting herself in a position you'd like to see her or Ant get through to the final. I agree Iga's the favorite, but I would not be shocked at all if she's not the champion when all is said and done.
Sweet. You guys are great. I'll have a parting shot as well. One name we didn't mention, and maybe we can get together after week one, break it down, and look forward to the second week of the season. I'm sure a lot of things will have been have shocked and surprised us by at that point. I want to say we haven't talked about Maria Sakkari at all. I wonder if we'll talk about her next week when we get together. But I'll leave it at that, and I'll say thanks to you guys for joining. Eric, thanks for the insights on the Netflix special. Richard, you're the best always, even though you're a Mets fan. Some people might take issue with that. I personally don't. I like the Mets a lot. I just want to put that out there. And, yeah, let's do it again the end next week. And it's just going to be funny if where we are next week compared to where we are now, we're still like at the very beginning of a season. We have no idea how crazy it's going to be. And I think by next week, we're all just going to be worn out and confused and stunned. And it's going to be interesting to talk again and just to note the differences between what's gone on between now and then. It always is the same way. And that's just the way it works at these slams. So I'm looking forward to it. So let's all try to get some sleep while we can.
Yeah, thank you so much, guys. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
All right, talk to you guys soon.
Thank you.
Thank you, boys.
Thank you.
This edition of the Lucky Let Cord podcast is a wrap. Special thanks to Eric Goodriss and Richard Pagliaro for joining me and talking Breakpoint and Australian Open tennis. It's going to be an exciting Aussie Open fortnight, and we're looking forward to being back with you in 1 week's time to talk about the craziness that we will inevitably be seeing from the Australian Open. You guys can follow Tennis Now always on the web, www.tennisnow.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/tennisnow. Also on Twitter at @tennis_now. And of course, we love it if you rate, review, subscribe to the podcast. It means a lot. We're going to try to pump out as many episodes as we possibly can this year. We want to be really active and kind of hit you guys up every week and keep you abreast of all the exciting happenings in the tennis world. So thanks again for listening. Thank you for your support, and we will see you next time. Enjoy the Aussie Open, and we'll talk with you soon.